Good afternoon, Your Honor, the Mayor, please report, and the Mayor of the United States. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
3 minutes, and it's Ling or Ling?
Lang.
Lang, okay.
Just ignore the I.
Okay, thanks.
The superseding indictment in this case more than adequately alleges a securities fraud conspiracy in the form of a prototypical pump-and-dump scheme. The district court's dismissal of the superseding indictment stemmed largely from two errors. First, and more fundamentally, the district court misconstrued and misapplied the Supreme Court's opinion in Simonelli. And second, the Supreme Court, the district court rather, seemed to read in to the fraud statutes the kind of mirror image requirement that this court has expressly rejected. This court should correct those errors and reverse. Let me begin by briefly defining the scheme at issue here as alleged in the indictment, because although the indictment is on the longer side, it contains a lot of factual allegations and quotations from social media posts and things of that sort, I think the basic structure of the scheme here was very simple.
Before you do, remind me, the superseding indictment was February of 23.
Correct.
And then the first motion to dismiss hearing and a bill of particulars was the next month, March of 23.
I believe that's correct.
But then the actual dismissal order was on the eve of trial in March of 24?
Yes, March of 2024, that's correct.
Okay. And I'll just sort of preview my concern. At that first hearing, the government attorney, Mr. Armstrong, it is clear to me that Judge Hainan was unsure what this, it's a long indictment, 44 pages, but he was asking questions like, well, don't you still have to list the misrepresentations? And don't you have to list the victims? And Armstrong was saying, actually, that isn't required in an indictment. You'll see that evidence at trial. Do you recall those statements?
Yes, I do.
So was this indictment, when the judge was trying to grapple with it, is it one where you don't even have to list the false statements, nor do you have to specify the people whose money was taken?
A few thoughts about that question, Your Honor. So I think the first response is, as a general matter, of course, at this stage, we're looking at the indictment through the lens of Rule 7. So the pleading requirements are, the bar is relatively low in terms of alleging sufficient facts to put the defendants on notice. So whether or not the indictment alleges or names every victim investor, I don't understand that to be required at this stage, as long as the indictment is sufficiently specific to put the defendants on notice. And I would say, as a general matter, especially when it comes to market manipulation schemes or pump and dump schemes, I don't know that it would be realistic to expect an indictment to list every individual victim investor, particularly what we're talking about.
But you will have to put someone on to say, I was materially induced to give up my money.
I agree, as a general matter, victim testimony would be the best way to prove those kinds of elements, material misrepresentation, deprivation of money or property. My understanding from the trial team is that that's the plan. That
yes.
kind of evidence will come in trial.
Yeah.
But
these aren't really Simonelli points. It's just, I think, my view is Judge Hainan was thinking, I don't see a fraud where one defendant took money from one victim. I'm a little confused. Help me, government. This is an open market. So he's really worried about privity. Do you agree with me?
I agree with you that there is a sort of privity concern, and it does come through in Judge Hainan's opinion. I think respectfully that concern is misplaced because there is no privity or contractual privity requirement in the fraud statutes. So again, I agree that this indictment, as Your Honor said, is on the longer side. It contains a lot of allegations about social media relationships between the defendants and their followers. But I do think the structure of the scheme here is very straightforward, notwithstanding.
And the only order we're looking at is a dismissal based on Simonelli. Is that correct?
Exactly.
Okay.
That's
so go ahead with your argument.
And I would also say, just for completeness, I think the district court's order denying the government's motion to stay pending appeal also adds a gloss on what Judge Hainan was thinking. But yes, the order being appealed is the order granting the motion to stay.
Wait, he denied a motion to stay?
Yes, there is another order denying the motion to stay. That's at docket number 642.
So the dismissal was for prejudice and he didn't stay it. What does that mean happens?
So I believe, and I apologize, I don't have the rule in front of me, but I believe while a government appeal from the dismissal of an indictment is pending, the district court still retains some authority to issue pretrial orders.
I see.
The best order for the
okay.
defendants.
Okay.
But in any event, yes, the operative order is the order.
Okay.
Quick question.
Oh, go ahead.
No, well, Simonelli, the language in Simonelli, it talks about schemes to deprive people of money, property, whatever, but to deprive. The indictment uses the language inducing people to part with their money and property. Is there any meaningful difference between inducing people to part with and depriving people of?
I think at least on these facts, there is not. And there are a couple of reasons why that's the case. So first of all, the indictment contains a number of paragraphs where it alleges that victim investors were induced to purchase. So they were induced to make purchases of securities. So paragraph 1, paragraph 14 contain those types of allegations. Under the circumstances here, we're talking about basically a pump and dump scheme. Those allegations are effectively allegations that victim investors were induced to part with or be deprived of their money because they had to make those purchases. If there were any doubt, and this I think relates to a Simonelli adjacent issue that the district court also addressed, if there were any doubt that a victim in that situation is being deprived of their money, that doubt was resolved in the government's favor by Cusesis, because Cusesis held that even if a victim gets a quid pro quo of equal value when they're fraudulently induced into making a transaction, that victim has still been deprived of their money or property. This court, of course, had already held in Green Law, as we explained in our opening brief, relying on the Supreme Court's earlier decision in Shaw, that there is no pecuniary loss requirement. But to the extent that there was some uncertainty, and I think there was, judging from the fact that Judge Hayden, for example, cited the 11th Circuit's opinion in Tapaloff in his order granting the motion to dismiss, that uncertainty has, again, been resolved.
Is Green Law's good law even post-Cusesis?
I understand it to be. I don't see anything in Green Law that Cusesis overrules. Again, Green Law agreed with, I think, the basic proposition that the Supreme Court embraced in Cusesis, which is that there is no pecuniary loss requirement.
Cusesis, like Simonelli, also uses the depriving language. But is your view, if I hear you correctly, that on these facts, depriving people and inducing people are potato, potato?
I agree with that, Your Honor, again, because the inducement in this case is a purchase with money, and Cusesis confirms that being fraudulently induced into that kind of transaction is a deprivation, notwithstanding the receipt of a quid pro quo in exchange.
Let me ask you even more specifically with regard to inducement, does it make a difference if the defendants are talking about their own strategy in terms of what they intend to purchase and hold and sell, or whether they're making representations about the quality of a particular stock or security?
So, of course, the false statements that induce the deprivation have to be both false and materially so. And there may be some debate in a trial, indeed I expect there will be, over whether particular statements were actually false or misleading or materially.
Or an opinion.
Yeah, or
a defendant's opinion that somebody acted on. Well, if this person thinks X, then I should act on that.
Yes, exactly. And there are some allegations, of course, along the lines of the defendants told their followers, I am going to hold on to my investment. I think the security will reach a particular price. I would say it,
there's no false statement in that. The falsity is as to the value of the security, right?
So a couple of things. So yes, I think generally when there are statements that are alleged to be false about the value of the security, the underlying value of the company, when they make statements about things like due diligence or what they call catalysts that they allegedly or they purportedly thought would increase the price of the security in the future, I think those kinds of statements are more obviously objective.
Is that just a function of materiality?
It's partly a function of materiality. I think also it's a function of whether a statement is susceptible to being false or true. And the rest of my answer to Your Honor's question, Judge Higginson, is that a statement of belief can be false to the extent that it falsely represents, I sincerely hold the belief. So I believe this security is going to increase in value. Whether it does or not, if the belief is sincerely held, may not be true or false.
Because you remember, Judge Hayden, one concern was sort of the limiting principle, which is every time someone sort of cries out to the open world what you could call puffery, this thing's worth a ton, and then they turn around and sell it, are they all facing felony securities fraud prosecutions?
No, and I think the important limitation there, which the Supreme Court in Lucesis spends a fair amount of time emphasizing, is materiality. And as we point out in a footnote in our reply brief, not every false statement, particularly statements of negotiating position, statements of puffery or seller's talk, those kinds of statements have generally been rejected as being materially false.
I appreciate both of you have briefed this superbly, only because I'm assuming you have the sophistication answer. Is there a jury instruction in these type of open market frauds that tell the jury you can't convict because of puffery?
I haven't seen a jury instruction along those lines, and I don't believe this court has a pattern. Certainly that's something that we might discuss as we ramp up for a trial, but I can imagine a jury instruction along those lines explaining the difference, particularly when it comes to materiality. But I think to answer your Honor's question, that really is the limiting principle here. As I read Judge Haynes' opinion...
And intent to defraud.
Of course, and intent to defraud as well is one of the limitations. And with respect to the superseding indictment, I think intent to defraud is amply alleged, as are the other elements of securities fraud. With respect to Simonelli, the district court's opinion, I think, is primarily reliant on a misinterpretation of Simonelli. Because Simonelli, of course, was a narrow opinion of the Supreme Court. Simonelli tells us that the right to control theory of property, really, as developed by the Second Circuit, is inaccurate. The idea that there is a right to potentially valuable economic information necessary to make economic decisions is a property right. That idea is what Simonelli rejects. But Simonelli, in the court's opinion, and of course emphasized in Justice Alito's concurrence, it's very clear that it goes no further than that. And it doesn't opine on the government's ability to retry the defendants on the theory that what they were seeming to obtain was the money and the contracts as part of the Buffalo Million initiative. And indeed, the case has now been remanded back to the district court for the government to do just that. So in this case, the theory of fraud is not that the victim investors were merely deprived of information, which is what the district court seemed to believe. Of course, the victim investors were deceived. And as I think this court explained in Green Law, deceit, of course, is part of any fraud scheme, but that doesn't make it the property interest that is the object of the fraud. In this case, as the superseding indictment alleges, the object of the fraud, and logically the only way the pump and dump scheme could have succeeded, was to induce victim investors to part with their money. And as we explained in our briefing, including in our post-Lucesis letter brief, quite a number of courts have distinguished Simonelli on exactly that basis. Probably the best example of which is Lucesis, in which the Supreme Court explained that the fraudulent inducement species of fraud is not merely a repackaging of the right to control, because the protected interest is different. In a fraudulent inducement case, somewhat like this one, the object of the fraud isn't merely deceit. It's not depriving victim investors of accurate information, although that is part of the scheme. The object is to induce them to spend money. And to the extent that the district court believed that the scheme was indifferent to its effect on the victim investors, or that the victim investors received the benefit of their bargain because they obtained securities in exchange for their money, I think Chrysesis forecloses that line of reasoning, because the victim investors were still deprived of their money when they were fraudulently induced to make those purchases.
It still sort of does come back to the privity in terms of Judge Haynen's thinking, there's no allegation anywhere in here that these defendants got this victim's money. That what they wanted is the stock to get inflated, and then they dump. And that's their money. So there's just not that equivalent. So I guess to put that as a question, what's our Fifth Circuit's clearest statement that privity is not required?
This court's clearest statement that privity is not required comes from Baker. In Baker, this court clearly held that there is no mirror image requirement. So the money that flows out of a victim's pocket doesn't have to be the same as the money that flows directly into a defendant's pocket. The facts of Baker are analogous to the facts alleged in the superseding indictment, because Baker also essentially involved investor fraud. The defendant in Baker lied to investors to get them to invest in Arthrocare. Those investors parted with their money in exchange for those shares. And the defendant's gain was not the mirror image of those investments, and the defendant wasn't in privity with those victims. The defendant was trying to get bonuses and appreciation of the defendant's own stock options. But it was sufficient.
Again, back on chronology, I noticed that, that Judge Hanen took a guilty plea, I assumed, to the same scheme from this fellow Knight.
Yes, Mr. Knight, that's right.
But he took the guilty plea post-Simonelli.
Yes, so the
If the problem in this charge, the scheme charge, were a Simonelli problem, how could he accept that guilty plea? Or did the fact that Mr. Knight talked about idiots, sort of, and I don't say that sarcastically, but apparently he did, that somehow ties up his case differently than these defendants? Do you have a thought on that?
So Mr. Knight and I believe the other unindicted co-conspirators, Mr. Savas, are both still pending sentencing. Their sentencings have been stayed pending.
Right, but he took a guilty plea.
Yes, I understand the logic of his opinion as applying equally to all of the participants in the scheme. So if this court were to affirm, I think we would have to revisit those.
But I guess I'm wondering, do you have any idea from the record how he could interpret Simonelli the way he did and still accept a guilty plea to something he didn't think was a crime?
Based on my understanding of the record, I don't have a good answer to that, Your Honor. I didn't participate in those proceedings. I wish I did, but I don't have an answer to that. The last thing that I would say on the mirror image front is that if the district court were correct that this kind of scheme were beyond the reach of the fraud statutes, that would effectively insulate wide swaths of securities fraud and market manipulation type fraud schemes from the reach of these Title 18 money and property fraud statutes. Because as a general matter, in an investment fraud scheme and a market manipulation scheme, the defendant isn't in contractual privity with the victims. The defendant is lying to the market to induce victim investors to invest. Smith, for example, the Seventh Circuit case that we brought to this court's attention in a 28J letter, that case, I don't see how it could have been prosecuted under the logic of the district court's opinion here, because the spoofing lies that the defendants disseminated to the market were, as the Seventh Circuit put it, filtered through the entire market. The deception wasn't directly communicated from the defendant to the victim, and the property didn't flow that way.
Your time, you just appreciate it. Thank you. You've saved 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Great. Mr. Rosen?
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court, Eric Rosen on behalf of the defendants, the appellees here, John Reichercheck, and also speaking for everyone else. We're asking this court to affirm the district court's dismissal of the indictment because it simply doesn't plead a scheme to the fraud. The issue is not, as the United States pointed out, whether the indictment alleges a specific victim or not. It doesn't allege any victim at all. That's the issue. There is no harm actually alleged. It's a fundamental misconception. The government's argument.
But the district court is really clear he didn't actually rule on a green law deficiency. He said this is Simonelli. He thought it was talking about information, not property and money. That was the very clear conclusion. He says, I'm troubled by a lot of things, but this is squarely controlled by Simonelli.
Well, he talked about green law. Involved two issues, intent to defraud and a scheme to defraud.
Right.
He said it fulfills these, it may fulfill the intent to defraud as the scheme to defraud. What he did was he looked at the sort of the open question left in Greenlaw. Greenlaw left that open question out.
But he ultimately says, quote, I'm quoting 9 to 12, I want to be clear, this survives Greenlaw, but it fails Simonelli. And 2 pages earlier, he said, quote, Simonelli applies squarely. So I guess I'll turn that into a question. Are you saying this indictment is deficient under Simonelli and nothing else, or is your argument different?
Well, it's deficient under the scheme to defraud elements.
Is it deficient under the Supreme Court's Simonelli reasoning? Because what was taken was information, not money.
Absolutely. It's absolutely deficient under that ground. However, the issue with Greenlaw and why it came into play in this case was not so much the intent to defraud issue, but the scheme to defraud, because the Fifth Circuit left open the issue of whether a scheme to defraud can have, in the jury instructions, financial gain or harm to a victim. And so he said, based on that, it doesn't, there is no harm to the victim. He went through Shaw, I looked at that, And because of that, the Simonelli...
Then what about the 28J, Judge Kearse, Judge Easterbrook's opinion, Smith? Because the spoofing looks really like a pump and dump. The victims who are harmed are very similar, right? These are investors that are duped to think that the market has given them a value, but in fact, it's the manipulator who's given them the value. How is that distinguishable in terms of harm?
Easily.
Okay.
Stock market is not, in this case specifically, it's not a zero-sum game. A stock market, people can make money. Simply inducing someone to buy something does not actually result in harm to that person. And that's the fundamental issue here.
That was an issue in Smith, too.
Because Smith involved commodities fraud contracts. Commodities fraud contracts, by definition, are zero-sum. They have to be. One person, if the market price gets changed, one person wins and another person loses. That's the issue. If you're lying about a commodities fraud contract, by definition, the object of the harm is to harm victims. That's entirely different from an actual functioning stock market where there's supply and demand. Not everybody loses. Stocks can go up.
And you think that paragraph where Judge Kearse and Easterbrook say securities frauds are open market frauds, what's happening is the public has been deceived that the market's determining a price, but in fact it's the inflator spoofer. How does that tie into, what's crucial here is it's commodities market versus securities? I don't remember that in the opinion at all.
It's just the nature of like why spoofing is a crime. It's because it injects a misrepresentation, the actual price of the commodity, and the second part, remember, it's not just deception.
Yeah.
It's deception and to deprive someone.
Yeah.
And the second part is, because of that misrepresentation, Your Honor, the victim automatically has lost money. It automatically has been harmed because it's a zero-sum game. And that's why a stock market is different. The government relies on generic accusations of it being a pump-and-dump scheme. Mm-hmm. And that's the problem. They say there has to be a victim in it because we call it a pump-and-dump scheme. But not all pump-and-dump schemes are created equal. Traditional pump-and-dump schemes...
But they're going to have to put a witness on, and in fact, Mr. Armstrong said he would. They have to put witnesses on that will say, because of these misrepresentations, I bought the stock I did. We were materially duped because of the false statements about the value. The government's got to put those on.
And I agree. But even if they put that on,
yeah,
where is the deprivation? And that's the problem. Deception, the indictment, over and over.
Well, they lost their money buying the stocks.
But it's not. But there's no allegations that it was because of the defendant.
No, but they'll get on the stand and say it. Armstrong said they would. You heard opposing counsel say they would. But it's pretty far afield from Simonelli, isn't it?
Well, but the problem is the superseding indictment does not say that.
But that's if we reinstate the indictment, you can move for a bill of particulars. You already have, right? But the question is there a legal deficiency here? It's not what information do you have already?
Right. Well, the legal deficiency is that there's no object pled to harm an actual victim. That's the problem. That's what the district court identified. If you read it very carefully, the government has invented a word called victim investors. There is no such word. There's nothing about a victim investor at all in the indictment.
Isn't that a function of privity? Am I thinking about it the right way? You're attacking privity by saying that there's no person directly harmed?
No.
Or are you talking about something separate and apart?
The privity thing, I think, is a red herring, mm-hmm. Your Honor. It's about the difference between a market that functions on supply and demand versus a traditional pump-and-dump market, which is a phony market. There is no actual market there. The whole thing, and what the cases that the government cites to, are cases where the entire market is artificial and fake, wash trading, match trading, control groups. That's not the issue here. The stocks at issue here were real stocks with real companies, and defendants didn't control them. The only allegations are deception. There's no issue, there's no, absolutely no allegation here that any object was to harm them. One of the things about influencers, Your Honor, is their entire business model is not predicated on harming their followers. Their business model is predicated on gaining followers. You wouldn't have as an object to harm your followers if you wouldn't go anywhere. Like, people followed them because they thought they provided good stock picks.
Well, the harm is this what was called amorphous public, right? These people who Knight called idiots, they see the false statements, they go buy it, it elevates the price of the stock, and that's when the manipulators who have falsely described the stock dump it. So they have harm because they've induced a lot of people to buy a stock based on their fake puffery. The minute all these, on Knight's word, idiots do that, they sell. So these people are being deprived of their money. That's the theory.
I think that was true if there's anything in the indictment about the stock then falling after that.
Ah, okay.
And there's nothing in there. The definition of pump and dump in Black's Law Dictionary that they even cited says it, you know, the market crashes after. That's why this is a fundamental difference. What the government is doing, what they've injected into the indictment, is a victim. It's just not there. And that's the problem.
Well, I agree. That was what Judge Haynen was saying.
Right.
Quote, well, how do we know the people who bought them ever saw any of these posts? That was his concern, but that's just a trial proof issue. The government may have a really high burden in these cases.
Well, I think his opinion narrows it down significantly to say, show me where, he asked over and over again, and I was in the trial court,
yeah.
Asked over and over again, what is the harm? It's not just deception, as Mr. Armstrong said, it's the deprivation. Where is it say in the indictment that the object of this of these defendants is to harm the victim, of anything? And the problem is
you were there, but now I'm looking at page 37 of the final dismissal hearing on the eve of trial. Question from the court: help me. What role do we think victims would play, Mr. Armstrong? I certainly expect that they'll prove up materiality. They'll prove how they relied, specific witnesses.
Right.
On the false information the defendants were putting in the market. So the government's going to put these victims on.
Well, he didn't dismiss it based on materiality. I agree with you, that's a trial issue. But it's an admission that they're not pleading that the object of the fraud was to harm victims. In fact, paragraph 12, I'm sorry, the light is dim here, but it specifically says, the defendants used their credibility to maximize their own trading profits through their tweets and posts in Atlas Trading Discord. Profits, not a crime. And then it goes on to say, often at the expense of their Twitter followers and members of Atlas Discord. How is this distinguishable from Kelly v. Bridgegate, where they wanted to shut down the bridge lanes, and then as an incidental byproduct of that, like just like often at the expense, as an incidental byproduct of that decision, they harmed the state money and property because of people's time and salary that they had to pay. The Supreme Court shut that down. They say the object of the scheme, not the incidental byproduct, has to be money and property. And the very allegations in the indictment say, we went through it in excruciating detail below, but the very allegations say, often at the expense of the Twitter followers. They're admitting that the object was not to harm them. That's the problem here. There is no object, unlike most indictments.
To induce them to purchase, hence lose money, to elevate the stock.
But that's the thing. That would be true, Your Honor, if there was a corresponding collapse of the stock after. I agree with that. There is not a single paragraph in this indictment that talks about anybody being harmed, any stock collapsing, or anything like that. That's why the government has to rely on these pumped-up cases where there's a complete artificial market. Here, this is, you know, a bunch of people, like millions of others, injecting shatter into the market. The only difference is they have a large Twitter following. But for the government, it didn't matter. There is a...
Again, I appreciate the fluidity and velocity of argument. But you heard two of my questions to him. How could this district judge have accepted Knight's guilty plea?
Oh, it's a complicated sort of timeline there, Your Honor. We didn't brief, so I believe, I'm not 100% positive, that Knight pled guilty right off the bat in sort of March, April, May.
I think he pled in February of 2024, right before this dismissal occurred. I may be wrong. There were two. Remember, there were two rearrangements. Knight's is not till February of 24. So it's 1 month before he dismisses. Everyone's got Simonella.
But now he's, I believe, those guilty pleas have now been held in abeyance and they have the ability to withdraw pending this outcome here.
Okay.
So they haven't been sentenced. Those cases are on hold. So, you know.
What about my other question in terms of, let's say you don't prevail. Let's say we reinstate. What's the jury instruction that you want the jury to hear to get at the same, you think, elemental deficiency.
What is the harm to victims here? What is the, how do you find that the object of their scheme...
So jury, you must find beyond a reasonable doubt, finish the sentence.
That the object of the scheme by defense was to harm victims. And they can't do that. Judge Willett brought up, I think you said that it was dismissed, the indictment was dismissed with prejudice. It wasn't, it was dismissed without prejudice.
I said that.
Oh, sorry, I apologize.
No, I made the mistake. Let's not give them a mistake.
It was dismissed without prejudice. And that's a
that's
very
important.
Interesting yeah. problem here, because why didn't they just go back to the grand jury, insert a paragraph that talks about the victims? We wouldn't even be here. It's been a year and a half since this whole thing came down and granted justices happened. But the reason is because they can't do that. They can't show that the scheme in a major market with thousands of other buyers, a fluid interplay of supply and demand, which is the crux and the gravamonte of market manipulation, they can't show that any object was to harm a victim. Over and over again in the indictment, profits, profits, profits. That's not illegal. Deception to get profits is not illegal. It has to come at the expense of someone. Crucissus, the amazing thing about Crucissus, you know, the government thinks it's good for them, we think it's good for us. It uses the term victim 50 times. 50 times. I think Greenlaw uses it 8 or 9 times. I know Fridge State uses it at least 4 times. And going back to McNally in 1987.
This is where it all started, right?
Right. Deprivation of property. And the judge read this over and over, and he's like, where is it? He invited the government to tell them, where is it about deprivation? And they couldn't. They couldn't. The exhibits they created, why we put in the stuff about Dr. Garibaldi, was because it was all about profits. They got excluded because they couldn't show anything about fraud. And I know that generally you all only look at the four corners. I know that it is an uncontested fact that the government could not show that any of the money came from a victim or that there were victims. It's not about identifying individual people. It's not about privity. It's about the difference between a traditional pump and dump. A traditional pump and dump, which the government wants this court to believe, wanted the by using generic accusations in the indictment, which we don't have to credit, but using generic accusations and something here, where there's a huge fluid market and some and they're injecting at best, and we dispute that, of course, but they're injecting at best deception into the market. But there's no single allegation that any stock took a hit because of that or did anything because of that. And I know I set up, we're not saying this something like this could never be prosecuted. We're not saying traditional pump dumps have nothing to do with that. That's a red herring, because those are, there's no market at all. It's completely fake. Here, there's a completely fluid market. So the government's sort of insinuation that this would harm anybody. We're looking for a very narrow decision. All I ask is you go through and see where does it allege that the object is to harm, and it just doesn't. The words, and they can't, which is why they didn't go back to the grand jury. We've gone to trial in April of 2024 instead of March of 2024. It would have been very easy for them to do that. But that's the fundamental issue with these new types of cases, these new types of where it's not that they control the market, it's not wash trading, it's not match trading, it's none of the traditional hallmarks of a control group. It's about people going on Twitter, not a crime, talking about stocks, not a crime, and the only alleged deception, the only deception is they're about their trading intentions. And under no circumstances, whether it's under Simonelli about information being the object, and it clearly was, because the Twitter and Discord people, they're the alleged victims in this indictment. And that's the other problem. The indictment doesn't even allege that the market is a victim, that the whole market at all is a victim. The only people they talk about in paragraph 12 are the Twitter followers and members of Atlas Discord. So it has to be the deprivation of information, because they don't allege that there's any, with specificity at all, that there's any artificialness in the market. And that's the whole problem Judge Hannon found after months and months of going at this, when finally we're at the pretrial, a week later we're having trial, and there's nothing about any harm to a victim, and they can't go back into the grand jury and say there was. And then
the difficulty, okay. And back on Smith, I'm reading this, the defendant's argument would fail even without Crucissus. Unlike the transactions in Cousis's, where the defendant directly lied to purported victims, the deception from spoofing, bracket, pump and dump, is filtered through third parties and the market as a whole.
Exactly.
But that is their theory here. There's a false statement that goes to the market as a whole. It induces the market to buy based on false information. That's how they profit.
So we got to be this rep. I agree with you. The spoofing.
We have lost money. Induced by the misrep.
But the object of the spoofing has to be an object to harm investors because it's a zero sum.
Well, they don't say that. In other words, the purpose is to inflate the value of the security, which they do in spoofing. They just never buy it. As far as I understand, maybe I'm wrong, the difference of the pump and dump is they actually buy it, then they dump it. Exactly the same injury and victimhood.
I would agree with you. Traditional pump and dump, where there's a circular market that's not accurate, is equivalent to spoofing. There's a reason why I think spoofing really only occurs in commodities fraud cases, and it's because of the fact.
Right, but they do say akin to. They draw the direct, it's dicta, but they draw a direct analogy to the pump and dump securities fraud.
Right, but
maybe the answer is Smith's law. That language is incorrect. But you're trying to draw a distinction.
I mean, you have to apply it to the facts, Your Honor. And the facts are it's a commodities fraud case. They talk about futures. And the definition of a future is it's a contract. One side wins, one side loses. If there's a misrepresentation, that drives the price. Here, the problem is that there is no closed market. There is no zero-sum game in a stock market that's influenced by the natural forces of supply and demand.
Counselor, if we agree with you, doesn't that have far-reaching impacts for any market manipulation scheme by a non-insider under 1348?
They could. First of all, they could have charged this case under Title 15, which has no property requirements at all. And they didn't, because we don't think that they could approve reasonable investor. They sought out, and so to the extent that they want to go that route, that's whatever. I mean, take your pick, and there's still an SEC case out there. But this case has, all we're asking is very narrow readings, and this case specifically, not any other case, has nothing in there, in the indictment itself, about the object being to harm. It doesn't even have an object paragraph, which is sort of stunning. And so I don't see how the government can say that there are victims out there when none are alleged in the indictment.
Thank you, counsel. Government reserve 3 minutes.
Good afternoon again. Thank you, Your Honor. Just three brief points on rebuttal. First of all, I'm very pleased to say I think we agree with my opposing counsel that privity is a red herring, that I understand opposing counsel to agree that there is no privity requirement. Second, with respect to the harm required, I think my colleague's presentation flies in the face of Cousis's, because I understood him to argue, among other things, that simply inducing someone to buy does not harm their property interests. But Cousis's could not be clearer that that is incorrect. Inducing someone into a transaction in which they give up their money or property, even in exchange for something of equal value, is fraud. That is the fraudulent inducement theory that Cousis's holds is viable. So to the extent that opposing counsel's argument and the district court's order depend on the idea that victim investors were not harmed because they obtained securities, and perhaps even the value of those securities increased for some victims, that is irrelevant. That does not defeat the theory of fraud in this case.
Is that the theory the district court adopted when it invokes Simonelli?
I understand the district court to be saying a couple of different things about the victims here. I think the primary error that the district court committed was a misreading of Simonelli and a holding that all the victim investors were deprived of was information. I also understood the district court to be saying where the district court wrote that the victim investors received the benefit of the bargain, I think that's the kind of reasoning that Cousis's forecloses. So I agree, I don't think that's the primary basis for the district court's holding, but it does seem to be part and parcel of the district court's reasoning.
But what about our dialogue with spoofing as a commodities market thing, and it has no real bearing on Securities fraud.
Well, that brings me to my third point. I think throughout this appeal, the defendants have been struggling to distinguish this case from other cases that they concede are still fraud, what they refer to as traditional or ordinary pump and dump schemes, commodities fraud. I have not heard a meaningful factual distinction between this case and those cases that supposedly can still be prosecuted under Judge Hayman's theory. So, for example, whether there's a completely fake market or a closed market, there are many securities fraud cases, including pump and dump cases, that don't involve what I think I would characterize as a fake market. United States versus Wharton, which we cited in our opening brief, is one example. Smith is another, where I don't understand how one can call the market fake.
Just in the last 20 seconds, if you were allowed to elaborate on the indictment, what would the object be? How would you describe the object of this scheme?
The object of the fraud, which I believe is alleged in the indictment, okay, was to induce investors to purchase securities so that the value of those securities would increase and the defendants would profit. Okay. So there is both a loss alleged in the pockets of victim investors and a gain to the defendants. That is structurally how pump and dump schemes work. I agree with Your Honor, Judge Engelhardt, that I think the district court's opinion here risks foreclosing a large number of securities fraud schemes.
I can't give him more time, so I'm just going to cut you off there.
I appreciate that, Your Honor. Right. We ask the court to reverse. Thank you.
Thanks. We appreciate argument, and we'll call the second case of the day.